It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running for the last couple of broadcasts of the month of April 2019. And then we begin a brand new month on Wednesday, which just curiously also happens to be the 26th wedding anniversary for Agnes and me. Yeah, isn't that nice? Mm-hmm. So we begin every program with gratitude. We begin every program with thanks to our subscribers. And in this particular instance, that would be thanks going out to the following. Back on Saturday, our subscribers for the 27th of the month are Robert in Australia, Susan, and Jules. And then yesterday, Sharon, Randy in PA, Philip, Charlene in Rhode Island, a member of the sorority of Leans, and Smitty in Florida. We don't have any subscribers for the 29th or the 30th of the month, simply because, well, with February being all screwed up, you know, short month, ends on the 28th, that kind of thing. PayPal boots everything to the 28th, you get the idea. So, no subscribers for the 29th or the 30th of any given month. It's fundraising-free radio this day and tomorrow as well. I enjoy that. I hope you do as well. And I guess because of the way PayPal treats subscriptions, that we can say that no one responded to Tony and Chico's offer to double the first month subscription for 5 new subscribers. I don't know why. I think that's a real shame. But thank you, Tony, for making the offer. Thank you so very kindly indeed. Now, it's the beginning of the week. And with the beginning of the week comes, well, you know, Morans. Moran Monday, as a matter of fact. And goodness gracious me, we certainly do have them. A reminder, if you'd like to augment your Horn live listening experience, go on over to headon.live and click on chat room, pick yourself out a screen name and a password, jump into the merry multimedia wacky zany real-time extravaganza that takes place during the 3 hours that this program is live, Monday through Friday, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 3 to 6 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. You will be immediately greeted by the likes of Anatole and Otto and Squeaky, capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a spacing guild master, has folded space today to become Man Cave, and, of course, pinch-hit midweek chat room utility moderator and all-around great guy, Steve from Georgia Stan. Okay, it's great good fun. I'm in there. You can be, too. So, yeah, Mondays, right? Mondays.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
Hello?
That's right. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up. It's Moran Monday on the horn here, just mere steps from the Carnival Midway, where only moments ago you were throwing ping pong balls at goldfish bowls in a dire effort to win a little tiny baby iguana that will someday grow to be the size of a Volkswagen Beetle and probably eat you. Yes, it's Moran Monday on the horn. Here behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas, we've got them all. Birchers, deathers, ninthers, tenthers, baggers, booger eaters, maggots, libertarians, Republicans, all. And a few extras, because Moranity has escaped the confines of the Republican Party and now runs rampant, kind of like the measles, through our body politic. Yes, indeed, yes, indeed. You can't tell the Morans without a program, and this is the program that tells the Morans. That's us, the horn. Less than 15 cents an hour of programming. You can't even buy two atomic fireballs for that, and you're through the thin cybernetic veil gateway, and hearing the howls, the squeals, the shrieks, the cries of the Morans gathered in together in the Moran Monday tent. A gentle reminder as the dulcet tones of the Calliope play on. Yes, a gentle reminder. Keep a close hand on wallets, purses, rings, jewelry, bracelets, earrings, necklaces. Purses. Did I say purses? Yes. Children, small animals, even that iguana that you won throwing goldfish bowls, ping pong balls at goldfish bowls. It'll be challenging if we were throwing goldfish bowls at ping pong balls, but anything can happen. And even European messenger bags, because the Morans can get grabby. Head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in Morans. You will. You really, really will. Almost too many to mention. And yes, the low-Q stream is the only stream running on White Rose Society. That's why the best thing to do is to listen via headon.live, because the stream works considerably better these days. And the fact of the matter is, you can also look up the horn on TuneIn and get the headon.live stream there as well. Okay? Good deal. So, now, speaking of Morans, we've got them. My pick for lead Moran this Moran Monday may very well be different from yours, but that's okay. In the Moran bedlam are many mansions, right? But in my case, yes, I'm going outside the boundaries of. I'm going outside the boundaries of Republican Morans, as I hinted in the initial oration, because we don't necessarily know what the politics of these Morans are. We know only that they are, in fact, Morans. Big Morans. Mm-hmm. Let's see here. How to approach this? Well, let's start with the basic figures. The spread of measles, which the United States declared to have been essentially eradicated in our country back in 2000 or so, is back with a vengeance. And I need not say, but I will anyway, that it is not simply a little childhood illness. You get sick with the measles, especially if you're older when you get them. And so it comes as, I forgot, but I didn't forget. That once upon a time, there was an episode of the Brady Bunch that dealt with the measles. And I guess it was Peter who, God, it's Moranish just to be talking about this in these terms, but damn, if that's the country we live in. Peter got sent home from school for having the measles. You know, this is like 1970, 1972, something like that. And pretty soon, the entire Brady Bunch all have the measles. And the way it was portrayed and presented on the program, it was to make it as though it was no big deal, and all the kids were happy little Bradys because they got to stay home from school for a week and had dots on their faces. Suffice to say, the scriptwriters treated Marcia's broken nose with more gravity than they did a family full of Brady measles. No? Steve in New York says, not to be a douche, but the Brady Bunch episode was the mumps. Yes, I'm a Brady nerd. I've got the clip. I wasn't planning on playing it, but it's the measles. And so well, it turns out that the anti-vaxxers, and I'm going to say this sort of slowly because it's like trudging through a really thick mud, getting through this level of stupidity. The anti-vaxxers have latched on to this scene from 1970 or so. That's right, 39 years ago, as proof, no, really, a kitschy, corny sitcom is being hailed as proof by anti-vaxxers that the measles are no big deal, and I suppose that this is just a big old conspiracy of some sort to, I don't know, make us measles proof, I think. I can't fully wrap my mind around just what it is that anti-vaxxers think. Because if I'm not even sure using the word think is the right word. But yes, yes, the anti-vaxxers are spreading that clip from the Brady Bunch, in which a bunch of smiling Bradys with dots on their faces get the measles as proof that it's no big deal. I told you they're morons. And the name of the episode is There a Doctor in the House? And according to NBC and NPR, among other outlets, the anti-vaxxer freaks, these purveyors of drop-dead, stunningly stupefying levels of ignorance, are sharing it around in memes and videos. And the NPR story notes that somebody named Dr. Tony Bark who runs around testifying against vaccines in courts and at public hearings because we have some sort of sick social disease that says we have to listen to the idiots, too. In fact, NPR quotes Dr. Tony Bark, I guess in a desperate attempt at something like both siderist objectivity. You stayed home like the Brady Bunch show. You stayed home. You didn't go to the doctor. Oh, my God, your kid could die. Oh, my God, this is a deadly disease. It's become that. But not, and so this is kind of a dual offer, a dual nomination. It's not just the anti-vaxxer idiots. It's organizations, news organizations like National Petroleum Radio, who actually quote these morons and give them more legitimacy by including them in what we're supposed to understand is unbiased, fact-based reporting. They cite another anti-vaxxer, another jackass, and quote that person as well. This is all too much for Maureen McCormick. You know, there's an entire generation of young, straight... I'm sorry, Jason. We know I can't cipher. No, it wasn't 39 years. It was 49 years ago. 49 years to 1970. I can't cipher on the fly. But that makes it even worse. But yes, Maureen McCormick played Marcia, and there's an entire generation of heterosexual young men, or heterosexual guys, who, when young men, had horrible crushes on her because she was the prettiest Brady. Granted, Piyush Jindal over in Louisiana Stan grew up idolizing Bobby. That's how he came to decide to tell people to call him Bobby, if you recall correctly. If you recall at all, you recall correctly. I'm not making that up. He said that. He decided he wanted to be Bobby instead of Piyush. Which is, I guess, fine. I mean, that's why, say, Mitch... No, it has nothing to do with the Bradys, but that's why Mitch McConnell goes by Mitch. Because, really, who wants to go by Addison, after all? Sure. And yes, I agree, Jason. Thank you for the correction, and I agree with your assessment. Effing morons. Uh-huh. Yeah. But Maureen McCormick, Marcia, a full-grown woman, hell, probably practically a senior citizen now, said, as a mother, I had my daughter vaccinated. She also noted that, yeah, she got measles when she was a kid. And she got really, really sick. I can echo that because I did as well. Having the measles was not a fun thing, she said. I remember it spread through my family. Oh, and by the way, it was 50 years ago because that episode came out in 1969. That was the year that there were 25,000 measles cases and 41 people died from it. But the anti-vax, well, how can we trust somebody like the CDC? What do they know? They don't even go on YouTube to find the truth. In an attempt to explain why the measles got less press, Elena Conis, who is at the University of California, Berkeley, and is a medical historian, said that in 1969 we had less control over infectious diseases. Smallpox was still a reality. There were far more cases of polio. In that context, it made sense to think of measles as a lesser threat. But thanks to the work of public health departments across the country, we took a different understanding of measles. Once the information began to get out about what could happen. Many parents think of measles as just a common nuisance which makes their children feel miserable and keeps them out of school for a while. But physicians today know that measles is more than a nuisance. This is from a 1964 public service announcement. The measles can bring with it like things like bacterial infections, fatal pneumonia, and brain inflammation. I mean, here I am, 56 years old, and I can still remember how desperately sick I was with the measles. It all happened in second grade, and the second semester of second grade is just kind of a blur for me because I got chicken pox, and then the mumps, and then the measles. Bang, bang, bang. And doing second grade homework when you've got a fever is no fun either. So that whole business about, oh, we get to stay home from school, even that's, you know, disingenuous. What's the answer? Well, if you look at the maps of the United States where it's impossible to go to a school without your immunizations, you'll notice things like measles aren't spreading. In my state, for instance, West Virginia, you can neither go to public school nor private school without proof of immunization. The only way you can be an anti-vaxxer, not immunize your child, is to homeschool them. And so, consequently, there have been no cases, at least thus far, of measles in West Virginia. But like I said, 700 cases nationwide. And as herd immunity goes down, while the ignorance that these malevolent freaks, the anti-vaxxers, goes up, so too will that number rise. Of the 29 people hospitalized in New York City, six of those people have wound up in intensive care. Two pregnant women have gotten the virus recently. And that may bode ill for the babies they are carrying. And yeah, the one flight attendant who carried the virus on a flight caught the virus somewhere between New York City and Tel Aviv, well, she's still in a coma. Isn't that bizarre that something from as far back as 1969 that isn't even, I mean, it's not like it's science or anything, but that is being used as an argument to not vaccinate? The hell is wrong with these people? As far as at least something in the way of a solution, any state that has a philosophical reasons excuse for not getting vaccinated needs its legislature to repeal that philosophical reasons. What are you, fucking Socrates? My ass. And really, religious excuses should not be an excuse either. Because if, the simple reason that if your deity of choice, which is, of course, the only real deity, yes, we understand that. And the rest of us are going to hell, certainly. But if your deity of choice says that the only way it's going to love you, he, she, it, is if you leave your children susceptible to deadly disease, then the rest of us have every right in the world to tell you that you're a fucking asshole for adhering to that kind of craziness. Because you are. You absolutely are. So you know what? We need to vaccinate the Amish. And we need to vaccinate the super-duper ultra-Orthodox Hasidic Jewish communities, too. Because their religion does not rise above our rights not to catch diseases. Especially since things like immunology are science-based, whereas religion is based on, I don't know, the position in which entrails fall when they come out of the guts of a goat. Modern science is superior to Bronze Age augury. How about that? Maureen McCormick is pissed. She says the sicko anti-vaxxers are using her image against her will. Jesus. So that's one more in. A pluribus unum. Oh, okay. Thank you. For all I knew, Steve, there was a mumps episode too. But touche, says Steve. I sit corrected. Must be on the subway right now. Yep, Tracy's better at ciphering than I as well. It was 50 years ago, 1969. And that was the first season of the Brady Bunch, by the way. Thanks, Herman. Is there a doctor in the house is the episode. You can probably go watch it if you want to. I never imagined, not even for a moment, that we would turn to a light-hearted bubblegum piece of of comedic sitcom for guidance. How stupid are these anti-vaxxers? There's weird stuff. I saw an advice column earlier today where someone was writing in, ask Aunt Gassy, whatever. My sister-in-law-to-be says I can only be in her wedding if I adopt anti-vax positions like she has. Aunt Gassy, whatever shall I do? And the reply came, unless you want to be an anti-vaxxer, just politely state that you would prefer not to be part of the wedding party. Okay. I guess this presupposes that you wouldn't just not, because that's a family situation. One's a young married couple, the other's going to be married. What do you do if both couples have kids and one doesn't vaccinate? Do you go to the family reunions? Do you allow your kids to get around the anti-vaxxer's little stewing mass of infections and pathogens? I don't know. Well, that's true, too. Scott in San Diego pointing out, regarding philosophical objection, no need to replace the legislators in such states. Just amend the law to require those wishing to invoke the objection to spell philosophical correctly on the first try. Well, that's a good one, Scott. Yeah, there's a cowbell, sure. So that's an early indication of the degree to which the Morans are among us. But God knows there's a lot more. How about Lindsey Graham, who showed up on Face the Prestitutes, or whatever it is, the CBS program, Face the Nation, this weekend, to answer hard, piercing, incisive questions by the multimillionaire for-profit media as to the misdeeds of Donald J. Trump. Oh, and by the way, speaking of Trump, over the weekend, just for giggles, I came up with an exhaustive, comprehensive list of Julius Caesar, of Donald Trump Roman Emperor names for the first bunch of Caesars. Julius Caesar, Caesar Disgustus, Tangerine Tiberius, Clementine Caligula, Chlamydia Claudius, Nitwit Nero, Gangrene Galba, Orange Otho, Victimizing Vitellius, I like this one, Venereal Vespasian, Dumbass Domitian, and Needy Nerva. And we can add to them from there. Cuckoo Caracalla. I like that one when it occurred to me. Who, in all the world's history, could ever have imagined that the names of the Caesars could come in so handy for dealing with the manifest ignorance of that walking, talking, breathing, semi-animated conglomeration of human fecal material that makes up Donald Trump? By the way, note from Ron and Raleigh. All kinds of stupid shit. Have you heard that bubonic plague is making a comeback among the homeless population in L.A.? Bring out your dead. Boom. Meow. Did you hear the orange idiot stating that women and their doctors are murdering postpartum infants? That kind of blinding stupidity is expected from Trump, but the hooting from his sycophants in the audience who actually believe this horse shit. That's the scary part. Oh, yeah. I've got it all. Because it is Moran Monday, and we do have a shit ton of work to do. Yeah, that Green Bay clavern was for the ages. Jesus. And that wasn't the only stupid thing he said. You know, we really haven't grandfathered him, but it just sort of, we take it as read, the degree of stupidity that's going to be included in it, right. Just wow. I figure you would probably just as soon not hear those clips, and that's fine. But he did. He's gone. You have to be supremely mentally ill to believe, let alone say out loud, in front of a couple of thousand people, that every time a baby is born, it gets wrapped up really nicely, and then the doctor and the mother decide whether or not to murder the baby. But the other side of that coin is that facts and truth are meaningless to Republicans and maggots, and particularly to the fetus fetish crowd, because their goal has nothing to do with babies. It has everything to do with exerting criminal control over how a woman manages the workings of her own body. But in the clips, it's not so much what the stupid fucker says as it is, as Ron alluded, the cheering of the faithful. But anyway, back to Lindsey Graham. The questioning was not of the highest caliber. But what I did find interesting was they did at least play the clip for Lindsey of he himself in 1999 talking about it not being necessary to commit a crime in order to cleanse the Oval Office. And back then, the Oval Office needed cleansing because it had a Democrat in it. And Lindsey didn't even have the nerve to say, hey, you know, I felt that way because it was a Democrat being impeached. I mean, that's obviously the answer. And God forbid that the person asking the questions would, you know, drill down on that. No. Instead, we got this.
We're not. The president seems to want to continue to litigate this. He came out this week and said and denied that he had ever fought or told anyone to fire Don McGahn, right, the White House counsel, right, but that directly contradicts sworn testimony that was in the Mueller report, where Don McGahn said he almost quit.
Yeah.
He was so pressured to fire the special counsel.
Well,
who do you believe?
I think it's just all theater. It doesn't matter. I don't care what he said to Don McGahn. It's what he did. The president never obstructed.
It doesn't matter.
God damn it. Lindsey Graham is allegedly a lawyer. In fact, he was in the Air Force Reserves as a JAG lawyer for a lot of years. I think he rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel, maybe even full bird colonel. And that, it's not what he said, it's what he did. That could not withstand a cross-examination from somebody who isn't even all the way out of the first year of law school. Which, of course, means that it can withstand examination from a multimillionaire in the for-profit media. Who just, oh, well. I mean, consider that statement. It's not what he said, it's what he did. Lindsey, honey, the saying things is doing things. But then again, whoever it is that was subbing in the seat there, she wasn't there to make Lindsey's life hard. She was there to make precious Lindsey's life easy. So she doesn't even mention the fact that there are 10 specific instances of obstruction of justice. Nope. She also does not mention the fact that, well, and because you listen to this program, you know this, she doesn't mention the fact that Robert Mueller actually declared that Donald Trump's actions were corrupt. Maybe the folks there at CBS haven't read that deep into the report yet. Who knows? I watched this shit live. Not that I was expecting any hard questions to be asked, but just because I wanted to see how it was they would manage to dummy this up. And they dummied it up real good.
Because, you know, if you ask Lindsey Graham hard questions, Lindsey might never come on your show no more. Right? Right.
Or not. The president seems to want to continue to litigate this. He came out this week and said and denied that he had ever fought or told anyone to fire Don McGahn, the White House counsel, but that directly contradicts sworn testimony that was in the Mueller report, where Don McGahn said he almost quit. He was so pressured to fire the special counsel.
Well,
who do you believe?
I think it's just all theater. It doesn't matter. I don't care what he said to Don McGahn. It's what he did. The president never obstructed.
It doesn't matter to you that the president is changing a version of events, or perhaps some would say lying.
If you're going to look at every president.
Wasn't that just precious? And some would say lying. You know who? You know who? You know who the some are who would say lying? People who know the difference between the truth and a lie. That's who the some are. God damn, some would say lying. The Fox News TV Radio Rwanda style book apparently spreads faster than measles. Some would say.
President who pops off at a staff.
Oh yeah, and pops. And as Sparky noted in the chat room a little bit earlier, Donald Trump passed his 10,000th official lie this weekend. In the days since January the 20th, 2017, to the present, Donald Trump has now told more than 10,000 lies. Yeah, really.
And, you know, ask him to do something that's maybe crazy, then we won't have any presidents.
But in terms of the firing, this was...
We won't have any presidents. My stars and garters, however will we... My great... We have to have presidents. Yes.
Don McGahn, the White House counsel, being pressured to fire the special counsel.
But he didn't. I don't care, I don't care what they talked about. He didn't do anything. The point is, the president did not impede Mueller from doing his investigation.
And it doesn't trouble you that the president is changing his version.
So now the law... That's against his lawyer. And so Lindsey Graham has now officially abrogated the entirety of the criminal law of attempt. Because attempt to obstruct justice is a crime, too. He has to know that. But the poor thing is terrified of being primaried from the right down there in South Carolina Stan. Doesn't have to worry about being primaried by whoever the Democratic nominee is, because they'll just get buried because it's South Carolina Stan. But there may be somebody who can out-maggot Lindsey that might capture the fancy of the folks in the Palmetto State. Yes.
Version of events.
I don't care what happened between him and Don McGahn. Here's what I care about. Was Mueller allowed to do his job?
Do you care about the fact, Lindsey, that Mueller said himself that the president's actions were corrupt? Does that matter to you? What a shame they didn't have that passage there handy. No. And the clip I have does not include the other part where he says, well, my advice to the Democrats in the House is if they want to impeach him, impeach him. And, you know, and then we'll ignore it in the Senate. Because we're going to rig it anyway, because, well, the Republican Party ain't nothing but a little old fan club, a little old Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I'll worry about it tomorrow, said Lindsey.
And the answer is yes. Name one thing that they did to stop Mueller from doing his job. And if you can't, then there's no obstruction.
Will you call him again to testify?
Not me? No, I'm...
I'm done. That's what he said. I'm done. Jesus. And it's just a matter of Donald Trump popping off at his staff. That is, of course, at wild variance with what with Lindsey Graham of 1999 by a lot. In 1999, he said, President Clinton doesn't have to say, go lie for me to be a crime. You don't have to say, let's obstruct justice for it to be a crime. You judge people on their conduct, not magic phrases. Mm-hmm. No, and by the way, it's not just Precious Lindsey. Let's set the Wayback Machine for Hypocrite and check in with a young John Thune, who back then was just a little old pissant, pipsqueak member of the House of Representatives. This is 1998.
There's one other issue, an important issue that I'd like to address, and that is the matter of trust. Lying to the American people is a betrayal of trust. And the pattern of deception and dishonesty that acts as a bodyguard to this president strikes at the very core of his ability to lead. Either the president chooses contempt and complete disregard for the truth, or his conscience is so diminished as to leave him unable to discern the truth from his lies.
Got that? Lying to the American people is a betrayal of trust. Huh. So that would mean we've got more than 10,000 betrayals of trust by this particular president. But remember, it's not the same because, well, Donald Trump isn't a Democrat. And it doesn't matter if you lie 100,000 times to the people of the United States if you're a Republican, because I-O-K-I-Y-A-R. It's okay if you're a Republican. Lie away, motherfucker! Lie and lie and lie, and when you're done lying, lie some more. Sure. That's where we are. Ooh, the Blue Hen. Well, that's not a Caesar, but it's still classical. Pontius Piles? Ah, okay. That works for me. More ends everywhere. Ron and Raleigh. Watch your right flank, Miss Lindsey. Where do you think Nimrata is at the moment? She's craving enough to kiss Trump's big orange tuchus. I'm going for the eyewash. Be back in a sec. I know. I will be applying the brain bleach sometime immediately following the close of the program here. We are not wanting for morons. There are many of them. Did you actually watch the thing on the Clavern meeting? Ron Chernow was doing the nerd prom, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. He delivered a good speech, even had a couple of chuckles in it. But that's why that's why Julius Geezer went to Green Bay to hold his Clavern rally there, to try to draw some attention, make sure that the maggots didn't tune in to the White House Correspondents Association dinner and actually learn something. There were a lot of low moments in that thing. Oh, but speaking of speaking of lawyers earlier and the fact that apparently you would never want Lindsey Graham defending you in anything, over on Meet the Press, Mrs. Greenspan sat down for a conversation with former acting U.S. Attorney General Sally Yates to try to get a handle on the Mueller report, the redacted Mueller report, the sorta reporta, and Mueller's take that he just couldn't prosecute the nitwit Nero. Here we go.
Speaking first to the Russian issue, which you just raised, if not for the Office of Legal Counsel prohibition against indicting a president, should there have been further steps? Do you think that there, in fact, on obstruction, would have been an indictment?
Well, you know, I've been a prosecutor for nearly 30 years, and I can tell you I've personally prosecuted obstruction cases on far, far less evidence than this. And yes, I believe if he were not the president of the United States, he would likely be indicted on obstruction.
So if he were the CEO of a company, if he were a private citizen, the at least 10 instances that are in the obstruction part of the report would have led to an indictment.
You know, I'm not sure that all 10 would. I think that Special Counsel Mueller did a very fair job in going through all 10 instances and laying out both the facts that established that he had committed the crime of obstruction, but also pointing out the defenses, both legal and factual. But there are several incidents that he described to which Special Counsel Mueller really couldn't point to any significant factual or legal defenses.
And which in particular do you cite as the most significant, the red flags that you see?
Well, the ones that he found that all three elements were satisfied were with respect to trying to fire Special Counsel Mueller through Don McGahn, then trying to get Don McGahn to lie about it later, not just his own lies, but trying to get someone else to as well, and then trying to reduce, to cabin the scope of the investigation to what's really nonsensical, to campaign interference in future elections.
Do you think that if he is not reelected, and the statute of limitations does not run out until 2022, that he could still be prosecuted after leaving office?
Well, the Mueller report specifically references that, both what could happen in the short term with respect to Congress's role, but also the long term, whether he could be prosecuted. But, you know, I think really the bigger issue is not just whether or not this establishes a crime that can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, but is this the kind of conduct that we should expect from the President of the United States?
Well, it's the kind of conduct you expect from this President of the United States. I think that's fairly obvious. Now, the one thing Sally Yates did not do is take that extra step and say that Robert Mueller could have at least said that he wholeheartedly disagrees with the 1970s Nixon-era guidance that says that you can't indict a sitting president. This he did not do. And she really doesn't bring it up. Interestingly, well, you already know this if you listen to this program. Ever since the Mueller redaction came out, we've been talking about what Mueller didn't do much more than what he did. And I have noted that if he was unwilling to prosecute Donald Trump, he damned well could have included a paragraph that said, I think he should be, and I'm only stopped from it because of this 1970s era guidance that says that the President of the United States is above the law. He didn't do that. But like I said, you've known that for 2 weeks because you've listened to this program. People who don't listen to this program may have been somewhat surprised if they tuned in Bill Maher over the weekend and heard Bill Maher declare the same thing that I said here 2 weeks previously. That Mueller bailed on his job. In fact, the way we put it here is he took a dive. He evaded his most solemn responsibilities. Let me see if I can find that particular clip. There it is. Hopefully it'll play.
Just because you have a stone face doesn't mean you belong on Mount Rushmore. For over 2 years, America has had a crazy person in the White House, and for over 2 years, the Democrats have done fuck all about it because they were waiting for Mueller. We all sat around waiting for Prosecutor Jesus to turn in his big report.
There's one problem with that. The Democrats have not had control of the House for 2 years. Because that's what Marr said, for 2 years, and for 2 years the Democrats have done fuck all. Marr can be like that.
And he came back with, ask someone else. We needed Superman, and we got Clark Kent.
That's clever. That's cute. Clark Kent. Including a video of Mueller with a big pair of black-rimmed nerd glasses. Clark Kent.
Trump calls the Mueller report the crazy Mueller report, and in a way he's right, because it's over 400 pages detailing terrible crimes by a corrupt president, yet Mueller does not prosecute. If Dostoevsky had written the report, it would be called Crime and No Punishment.
Hold for laughs.
Mueller's report is full of buts. Don Jr. met with the Russians, but Manafort gave internal polling data to a Russian, but Trump obstructed justice every day, but Robert Mueller, he loves big butts and he cannot lie.
See, that's what you get when you've got a highly trained team of comedy writers. He likes big butts. That's quality.
Bad guys win. This is why Clint Eastwood never made a movie called Clean Harry. Sometimes it comes down to you. The Attorney General is corrupt. The Congress is dysfunctional. What good is leaving a roadmap for impeachment if you know a tribal, party before country Republican Senate will never remove the president? Bob, your trail of breadcrumbs isn't good enough. We're not that smart anymore. America is an aging shortstop. You have to hit it right at us. That was for you, Bob. That reference was sport.
Nice reference, Bill.
Bob Costas.
To me, this report is summed up in the words, Donald Trump Jr. declined to be voluntarily interviewed. So make him.
Again, points that minus the really clever quips that were made here well over a week ago.
As long as it's by reason of duh, I'm plausibly too dumb to know what I was doing.
For a guy who didn't want to break precedent by indicting a president, Mueller sure created a lot of new precedents. Because that's what law is, new precedents. It's always...
Yeah, new precedents. But it's not just Mueller. Like I said, Lindsey Graham earlier with that clip eliminated the entire criminal law dealing with attempts. And as noted on this program, Mueller declared that ignorantia juris non non excusat. You can be too stupid to prosecute if you are near enough the centers of power, or if you are deemed to be supposedly wealthy enough.
He's evolving. You can't indict a sitting president. It's not in the Constitution. It's not even a law. It's a guideline, like drinking white wine with fish or not fucking your cousin.
That's good. That's funny.
It's a fucking memo. In Watergate, the special prosecutor, Jaworski, faced a very similar guideline, but he understood the big picture and his role in history, and he sued a sitting president anyway. Mueller could have done that, and the headline the next day would have been, Mueller breaks with precedent, indicts Trump, and then that would be our new reality.
Every bit of which is absolutely true. And every bit of which we had here 2 weeks ago. Now, we're an hour into the program, and, wait a minute, we've got some ciphering going on. Lee in New York doing the heavy lifting. Just to do the ciphering for you, Donald Trump has held the office of president for 829 days. I know, it seems much longer. Dividing that into 10,000, you get a little more than 12 lies per day. We have never had a president who lied 12 times per day. But what's kind of astonishing to me, and yeah, I did this because it's Moran Monday, so we do Morans at the beginning of the program. But the goddess of irony was working overtime this weekend, and apparently she got hold of the rot gut, because she worked it out so that there would be an NRA convention at the same time that there was another assault on a Jewish place of worship. That's really going an extra mile too far. We all know the details by now. One dead, three wounded. And a young white boy, 19, young white man, John Ernest, aged 19, took a firearm, a semi-automatic firearm, an assault rifle, and went after Chabad Poway in the San Diego area. He killed one member of the congregation. He killed her because she threw herself between the muzzle of his gun and the rabbi. The rabbi got a couple of fingers shot off. And later issued a statement saying that it was a miracle that the murderer's gun jammed. A miracle. Yeah. Well, it turns out that the 19-year-old white man, John Ernest, because of course, who did this, he has a family. And the family has hired a public relations firm, of course, because this is America. And they give in their press release the name and number of their lawyer. They said, call my lawyer.
But they said, "We are shocked and deeply saddened by the terrible attack on the Chabad of Poway synagogue. But, oh dear, but our sadness pales in comparison to the grief and anguish our son has caused for so many innocent people. He has killed and injured the faithful who were gathered in a sacred place on a sacred day. To our great shame, he is now part of the history of evil that has been perpetrated on Jewish people for centuries. Our son's actions were informed by people we do not know and ideas we do not hold. Like our other five children, he was raised in a family, a faith, and a community that all rejected hate and taught that love must be the motive for everything we do. How our son was attracted to such darkness is a terrifying mystery to us, though we are confident that law enforcement will uncover many details of the path that he took to this evil and despicable act. To that end, our family is cooperating with investigators. We ask only that the media and the public respect our privacy and allow the criminal justice system to work. Our heavy hearts will forever go out to the victims and survivors. Our thanks go to the first responders who prevented even greater loss of life and the well-wishers who have supported us, and we pray for peace." Given the fact that he posted his manifesto to 8chan, which is a seething, festering, filthy swamp of neo-Nazis and white supremacists and so-called white nationalists, I don't think it's going to be a very challenging breadcrumb trail for the authorities to figure out how he became radicalized. In fact, people saw his post to 8chan and did something. They called the FBI terrorism hotline and said, "Jesus Christ, look at this. You got to see this. He's going to do something." But he was already in the car and he had already hit send and he was already on his murderous mission when he posted it. The filthy administrators over at 8chan quickly disappeared the post. Because I guess maybe they've gotten a little bit better at spotting overt statements of the philosophies that they all hold after the slaughter in New Zealand. And in fact, this kid, this young man, this man with a gun, did not choose Chabad of Poway as his first target. No. He first tried to burn down a mosque. And then he did this. So he despises both of those monotheisms and the people who follow those faiths. Nevertheless, because it is Moran Monday, there's even a nomination to go with this horror. Because lo and behold, Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, the anointed booger-eaten future king of America, blamed, of course, Ilhan Omar. Because I guess he thinks that 19-year-old lily white man with a gun, John Ernest, was a big fan of Ilhan Omar. Yeah, there's no depth to which the sleazy gut buckets of the Republican right, the maggot right, and they're indistinguishable at this point, will not sink. It's who they are. And meanwhile, in Indianapolis, Indiana, Taliban, Indiana, the NRA was coming apart at the seams. Because, now, if I've got this right,
Ollie North, criminal, well, I mean, okay, pardoned criminal, tried to run a coup on Wayne the Peter, and Wayne the Peter ran a campaign against Ollie North. It is apparently full-on seventh grade over at the National Ruble Association, because they were trying to get a leg up on just which one of them was going to go down and take the fall as investigations continue into their conduct. For all we know, one of those remaining investigations that we don't know anything about may be of Russian money, I mean, Russian money in the National Ruble Association. And the Russian money that found its way into the pockets of, say, Precious Lindsay and Chinless Mitch. And the millions and millions and millions that were of NRA dollars that were poured into the campaign of Donald J. Trump. We don't know. We simply do not know. But they're making real haste to demonstrate their morality, even in regard to this horror. The ones who weren't blaming Ilhan Omar were still sort of blaming Ilhan Omar. Fox News TV Radio Rwanda wasted no time whatsoever in getting Louis Asparagus Gohmert, that noble pleader. This guy used to sit on the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Can you imagine that? Getting his opinion on why someone would shoot up a synagogue in California. If you haven't already gotten the hockey puck nearby, you might want to now.
I mean, earlier today, after this tragic shooting at the synagogue, you had somebody saying, well, I blame this violence on the president's rhetoric. You've got the most pro-Israel. I mean, for heaven's sake, he's got a son-in-law that's Jewish. This man has done more for Israel, according to Netanyahu, than any president we've ever had.
According to Netanyahu. Right. And yes, you heard that right. No, you heard that right. Louis Asparagus Gohmert went... He has a Jewish in-law as a defense to the hateful rhetoric in which he engages.
And yet they want to call him anti-Semitic? Again, watch what they say and figure there's a good chance they're projecting. Mm-hmm. It's what they're doing, and they're projecting that on the president. Look, it was the Democrats who were the only people who would not call out and condemn specific anti-Semitic remarks. And yeah. There's a price for not doing that.
Except for the fact that a condemnation of anti-Semitism and anti-Islamic bigotry was passed by the House. Louis Asparagus Gohmert, well, nobody's ever going to give him an award for his great big brain, because, see, when the anti-hate resolution came up, Louis Asparagus Gohmert voted no. His excuse for not voting in favor of an anti-hate resolution was that it became so generic that it lost its meaning or significance. In other words, if it had only mentioned Ilhan Omar, and if it had only mentioned anti-Jewish sentiments, Louis would have voted for it, but as soon as anti-Islamic rhetoric got into it, Louis, that's watered down now, because What do you mean we can't hate the Muslims? Yeah. I refer to you to that time when needy Nerva was speaking to the Republican Jewish Coalition. He said, "You're not going to support me because I don't want your money. Is there anyone in this room who doesn't negotiate deals? Probably more than any room I've ever spoken." Yeah. Then again, Louis Asparagus Gohmert also defended Steve King when it came out that he was palling around with neo-Nazis. And when he asked what was so wrong with using the word white supremacist. Mm-hmm. Many, many more ends. This from the from Agence France-Presse. A U.S. Army veteran has been taken into custody. This is terrifying. Of course, by design. That's what terrorists do. Mark Stephen Domingo is 26 years old. He's an Afghanistan veteran. He says he's Muslim now. And he's been taken into custody for wanting to detonate an IED at a white supremacist rally that took place this past weekend in Long Beach. Huh, how about that? There was a white supremacist rally in Long Beach, and a little ways further south, lo and behold, a white man with a gun goes in and shoots up a synagogue. Nah, there couldn't possibly be a connection between those two things. An FBI source got Mark Stephen Domingo to say that he supported so-called violent jihad and he wanted to become a martyr by doing some retributive violence against anti-Muslim bigots. According to the FBI, again, he considered targeting Jews, churches, police officers, but then he decided to detonate a bomb at this rally in Long Beach, which, incidentally, didn't even happen. So, it didn't take place. It couldn't possibly have motivated John Ernest, except for maybe talking about it. Right. This young murderer, alleged, had said in some internet posting, "America needs another Vegas event. That would give them the taste of terror they gladly spread all over the world." March 14th, he also said there were mosque shootings in New Zealand. There must be retribution. He didn't realize it, but all of the plotting he was doing was with an FBI informant working undercover. He took a substantial step toward making it a reality after he found out about the rally in Long Beach. For all we know, that was a red herring, but his substantial step was to buy several hundred 3-inch nails that he was going to use as shrapnel inside his IED. His rationale for the 3-inch nails: they would be long enough to penetrate the human body and puncture internal organs. The arrest went down when the undercover officer gave him devices that looked like explosives but weren't. And then they went to the Long Beach Park that had been selected as the venue for the rally to surveil the place. On the charges with which he has been served, he's looking at 15 years in prison on providing and attempting to provide. Uh-oh, there's an attempt. Maybe he'd better hire Lindsey Graham, because Lindsey Graham can then explain how we no longer have a law of attempt in the criminal law in this country, because, well, okay, wait, no. That only works if it's the president. And the president is a Republican. Yeah, sure. Wow. Lots of morons. Arnold says, not defending this piece of shit, but I find it odd that they don't intercept a white supremacist asshole, but they can intercept this guy. Well, this guy got targeted after they had seen his online statements, so then they went in and cooked up an operation with him, and he went along with it, and so busted. The ones who really mean to kill somebody, well, they go about it differently. Like I said, John Ernest pushed send on his manifesto even as he was on his way to the synagogue. Mm-hmm. Lee points out in regard to the Bill Maher clip, Democrats could have complained for 2 years they were out of power. Maher could not have agreed with you in last week's episode. He was off. So still, 2 weeks. So, still, we're ahead of the curve. Just works out that way. So we're nearing the halfway point of the program, and I hate to keep folks waiting, so let's run over and find out what's going on. Hey, Scott. Hey, oh, no, I got Chirps instead. Chirps got the first word.
It'll get worse because I haven't put the food dish down on the floor yet. Are you hungry?
No, I ate before the program.
Are you hungry?
Not really.
Chirps? Never mind. I won't torment you.
Agnes, Agnes, I didn't realize this, but you know, even after 26 years of marriage, you're still finding out new stuff. Agnes is the queen of ham salad.
Ooh.
Yes. I got a couple. I got a couple of those cheap dollar store canned hams over the weekend.
Oh yeah,
and she worked that stuff up, and I mean, best ham salad I have ever eaten in my life.
I can't tell you the last time I had ham salad. It's got to be 30 years ago, maybe more.
I mean, this stuff was good. No, it was beyond good. It was damn delicious.
Are those Plumrose, those little teeny tiny canned hams? I think they're called Plumrose.
That wasn't the brand of this stuff, but it was a one-pound ham. And it's canned, so it's not really like, I mean, you know, you could take it out of the can, you could bake it, whatever, but it also flakes really well, so it makes great ham salad.
Oh, yeah, yeah. God, now I want a ham salad sandwich.
Well, by God, if you were here, we'd fix you one, because this is some kind of good.
Well, I'm telling you. God, where to start? I've been bummed out since Saturday, as you can imagine. Because Poway, that's the pronunciation.
Okay, Poway, thank you, Poway. I had a 50-50 chance. I blew it.
Well, that's all right. Is only like 20 miles north of here. And actually, my landlord, it's a husband and wife team who own a number of rental properties down here in San Diego. They live in Poway. Their kids, hell, for all I know, may have gone to school with this kid, this John Ernest?
Yes.
And wait a minute. The lovely Mrs. Ernest, Mother Ernest, said something about, you know, we can only wait until, what did she say, the terrifying details are released by the authorities? Were those her words? Something along
right.
Well, Mother Ernest, in the early reporting, when they were out somewhere, Mr. and Mrs. Ernest, and good Presbyterians, I might add, they were out somewhere, and when the shit hit the fan in Poway, they were on their way back to the Ernest home, and I don't know if it's a cul-de-sac or a regular street up there, but apparently that early on, the Poway police and sheriff's people, whoever's in charge up there, had blocked off the entrances to the street on which they live, and they encountered them and then escorted them to the Ernest home. And she was quoted as saying, "We had no idea he even had a gun." Well, how's that for your attentive parenting?
I guess, you know, he's 19. He lives at home. Does he live at home? Was that,
I believe so, yeah.
And so he just kept an assault rifle under the bed?
And if I'm not mistaken, in California, you've got to be 21 to have one of those types of weapons. I believe I heard that on the news today. So you got a couple of clueless Presbyterian parents who've hired a PR guy to field media inquiries, et cetera, and maybe film offers or book offers or whatever. But, and then today's news, this business, pardon me, this business up in Los Angeles where this numbskull, you know, this is California. This is a blue fucking state. And yeah, I know up in the land of Jefferson, up in
It is a blue state, Scott, but it's also a huge state.
Yeah, I know.
And one of the things that the framers of the Constitution worried about was how big a state could get before it became ungovernable. And y'all do a decent job of governance. But with that many people, how can you expect to catch them all?
Well, yeah, I know. I get that. And I think at last count, we had something like 36 million people residing here in the Golden State. And most of them they've got their heads on correctly. You know, out in the hinterlands, up in Sparky's neck of the woods, I'm sure there are some malcontents. But, and then Trump's response, or as I call him, President Toe Cheese, his response to the synagogue shooting, something like they say it's a terrorist act. That's hard to believe, I think, with the words that he used. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. He doesn't believe the report of his, you know, of law enforcement people or he finds it hard to believe that people would listen to him and act upon what they're hearing spewing forth at these rallies. It's enough to make one heart sick, Bob. I mean,
yeah, it is. And the fact and the fact that you've got your Louis Gohmerts and your Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz anointed booger eating future king of America to immediately jump out and run cover for the real causes of all of this shit. No.
Well, see,
it's that kind of shit that makes you think that this problem will not be solved because there are so many people who don't want to solve the problem.
Well, you were quoting Lindsay on Face the Nation Sunday, which I watched and tried not to regurgitate my coffee sitting here watching it. And yeah, they run cover, they run interference, they apologize and enable and explain or obstruct. They do everything that they can do to make harmless this guy, Mr. Trump, running interference. I'm sure that if they still used fax machines, the motors would have been burned out by now, sending out the official talking points to all the Republicans. And on a related topic, what day was it that Biden announced? Was it Thursday?
Yeah, it was Thursday.
And he did it by way of a video. And in the video, he went into the issues facing or the occurrences down in Charlottesville a couple of years ago. And Trump's response to that was something along the lines of, I never said that I was supporting the Nazis and the white supremacists. I said there were good people on both sides. And then Trump further tried to clarify it further by saying, I was just referring to the people down there on both sides
who went to try to save a statue.
A statue, yeah. But I can't imagine people on the liberal or progressive or even moderate parts of the scale going out to demonstrate in favor of a statue of a Confederate so-called hero. So if there were good people on both sides, and we know that one side didn't want the statue to go away, and we can suspect highly that the good people on the other side weren't there in support of the statue, I would ask Trump, what were the good people on the opposite side from your realm, what were they there for? Were they good? They weren't good people there decrying the removal of the statue. What were those good people on the other side doing, Mr. Trump? But nobody thinks to ask these fairly simple questions that spring immediately to mind. I mean, they do in my mind anyway. This stuff doesn't happen here as a rule. Yes, we have crime in California. Yes, we have crazy, demented people here in California. But normally they confine their madness to social media or what is that thing called, 8chan?
Yeah. First there was 4chan, then now there's 8chan.
Oh, good, good. I was thinking about quadraphonic records and stereo systems the other day. Do you remember those?
I remember when AM quad was going to be the first AM stereo, then AM quad. And then there were some like Cadillacs and shit that would have FM quad, but nobody ever really wanted to broadcast in it because it was too much of an upgrade.
Well, and the other thing with AM stereo, which a number of stations did use, The FCC, unlike with color TV back in the 50s, the FCC, whose job it is to make such decisions, would not come down on a particular, format, but system of broadcasting AM stereo. There was the Motorola system, the Con system, and another one that I've since forgotten. And if there's no
standardization,
yeah, then they're not gonna, you know, it's not gonna
catch on with the public. It's like the early battles between VHS and Beta.
Yeah, or better yet, going back to color TV, there was the RCA electronic compatible color, which you could get on an existing set or on an RCA color set. But there was also the CBS version of color, which actually yielded better color, but it wasn't compatible. In other words, if they had picked the CBS system, it would have made all current black and white sets obsolete, because they couldn't get any kind of a picture, black and white or color.
Well, that was going to work real well.
Yeah, but back in those days, the FCC actually did its work and picked, yes, Chirps, your window is open. You can look out your window.
I think one of the most interesting among those is back in the mid-70s, after the first oil crisis, we started looking at fuel efficiency. I have never heard Chirps get so wrought as she has been the last few days.
Well, I don't know what's up with her. Anyway, go ahead.
But there were two competing theories for how to deal with getting lead out of gasoline and working on fuel efficiency. And GM came up with this thing called the catalytic converter.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Which put out, a new round of gases. Namely, what was it, SO2, sulfur dioxide?
Yeah, there was one thing that it didn't do too well, and I can't remember what it was that it emitted.
Another system that said, let's look at how we burn it. And so I think that was through Chrysler, and they came up with something called lean burn technology that actually shut down some of the cylinders. And now, lo and behold, that's all the rage. And for instance, GM, the big eight-cylinder engines that they put in things like Tahoes and their large trucks and Suburbans and stuff, when you get up to highway speed on the interstate, that thing will knock out four. The computer will knock out four cylinders.
Yeah,
shut
you
them
rented
down.
A vehicle that had that on one of these trips, yeah, that you made. Yeah,
and it works for it, but. We all got saddled with the catalytic converter because that's the standard that was adopted.
What was the Wankel rotary engine that I believe Mazda had?
Yeah, they've pretty much given up.
For
they've given up on that because
mileage?
it can't meet emission standards.
Oh, okay.
The rotary engine first found its greatest use and productivity in aircraft engines.
Hmm.
And it makes a unique noise. The last thing that they were putting that rotary engine in was the RX series sports cars. But they,
yeah,
like I said,
Mazda,
they,
isn't it?
Yeah, that is Mazda.
Yeah. Well, you talk about engines in cars. If you've seen the movie Tucker about the fellow who tried to buck,
yeah,
Detroit and create his own line of cars. in his prototype, I think it was a case he couldn't get the steel or something, or iron or whatever it was he was making the engines out of.
Yeah, they made sure he couldn't get what he needed.
Yeah, his prototype had a helicopter engine in it that they had to lay it on its side or something, because by its very nature, a helicopter engine is like, if there's no way to put it in vertically in an automobile, so they had to lay it on its side. I thought those Tuckers were nice-looking old cars.
Oh, they with the center headlight. And And, his big innovation was putting in seatbelts when Detroit said, oh, we couldn't possibly put in seatbelts. That would make the car entirely too expensive to purchase, and the consumer doesn't want them anyway.
Yeah, and this is back in the late 40s.
Right, yeah.
He had a number of, wasn't his braking system a more advanced system than what Detroit was putting out?
I don't fully remember. We got a note from Jason, who is a fellow Californian with you, who says 36 million? No, it's now 41 million in California, and yes, it's ungovernable.
Well, is it really?
What California is a nation within a country.
Well, yeah.
And there are theorists out there who say that, when the United States eventually does break up, that you'll have the states of the Pacific Coast and maybe Arizona, maybe Nevada, joining together as one unit, and maybe the Atlantic, the Atlantic East, say from Pennsylvania up, maybe Pennsylvania, but New York and New England, and maybe stretching over as far as Michigan, maybe Wisconsin and Minnesota, being another one, and then the rest of it's just going to be Jesus land.
Well, yeah, that's we've been on our way in that direction for some time.
Yeah. But getting back to the shooter there in San Diego.
Yeah.
He did leave a manifesto that was remarkably similar to the murderer in Christchurch, New Zealand. I don't know if our buddy in New Zealand's listening or not, but if you are, hey. and while we talk about the fact that he targeted a synagogue, these monsters have a reason. I'm not saying, I don't even want to use the word reason, Scott, but they outline a process by which they have arrived at the sick conclusion that they have to kill Jews. Okay. And for instance, in his manifesto, John Ernest described immigrants to the United States who, aren't white immigrants. I mean, we're not talking about the Norwegians that Trump wants to immigrate here. We're talking about people from south of the border, brown people, people who are more indigenous than they are Hispanic. Not that these murderous racists and bigots know that. But he described them in his manifesto as, quote, useful puppets for the Jew in terms of replacing whites. And see, this is the... It took a long time, but it used to be that... At one point or another, every immigrant group has not been white. I know that sounds crazy, but it's true. No Irish need apply. In the mid-1800s, Irish people were depicted in caricatures as being ape-like.
Mm-hmm.
And Italians weren't white. When the stories first came out, you remember your Hardy Boys?
Oh, yes.
Well, they had a friend who was Italian or Mediterranean of some sort, and he was always referred to as olive-skinned.
Yeah.
And, as a little kid reading his Hardy Boys, I never understood that, because all that I knew of olives is that they were either fucking green or black. I never knew of any flesh-colored olives.
Of course, now it could have been he had complexion problems and he was olive loaf skinned.
That's just nasty, Scott. But yes, yeah, maybe he was pickle and pimento loaf skinned. I don't know.
Yes,
but olives.
Or head cheese.
And so everybody has gotten the treatment along the way of, and so this is in when you see phrases like this, and again, this 19-year-old man with a gun. probably was of average intelligence, but it sounds like, to listen to what his parents had their public relations person say, that he didn't learn that shit in their house. And useful puppets for the Jew in terms of replacing whites isn't something that he just came up with over his Wheaties one morning. And so what you see in that sentence is that the, and it took a while, but Jews became white. Because they are, mostly. At least I can never keep my Sephardic and my Ashkenazi straight. But the group that's, you know, European Jewry, white. And so they got white in terms of the culture. And what this is a de-whitening of Jewish people. Useful puppets for the Jew in terms of replacing whites. Now, of course, you got to remember, Scott, Jews will not replace us was the chant of the very fine Nazis as they marched through Charlottesville.
And this is why it makes perfect sense that this screwed up kid, young man.
And it's the European Jewry is Ashkenazi. So, okay, thank you, Jason.
He hears Trump talk about fine people on both sides in Charlottesville. He sees the coverage in Charlottesville where the tiki torch bearing hordes are shouting, chanting, Jews will not replace us. And he takes it in his otherwise empty head to trot on over to Poway with a gun that he's not supposed to have, being age 19. And thank God, or whoever's responsible for such things, that the gun apparently jammed.
Yeah, but really, I don't think you call something like that a miracle after somebody's already dead and two or three others have been shot.
Well, no.
I guess that was just an unfortunate choice of words.
Don't get me started on divine occurrences anyway, because it is just so much crap. That crazy notions that people buy into, and I guess the reason I'm so vehement, and it may upset people who are true believers and stuff, but over the weekend I watched Julia Sweeney, who was in the Saturday Night Live cast for several years, came to her senses, and she's done a couple of videos, but the one that I watched over the weekend, like 2 hours worth, but well worth every minute, was Letting Go of God on YouTube. And if you've ever wondered about such things, I can highly recommend that. Because she puts forth some pretty good rationale for why and how she came to making that choice. But I don't know. I've got one more thing real quick for you, and I want to free up the line here for whoever else wants to check in.
Okay. Well, time out. Let me just finish this one thought here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
About the de-whitening of Jewish people.
Yeah.
The other part of it, though, is that they attack Jewish places of worship and they attack Jews, and they do so because they and you know, the guy who shot up the Tree of Life synagogue said the same thing. And the guy who shot up the two mosques in Christchurch said the same thing. The bottom line for them is immigration. In the case of this synagogue and in the case of Tree of Life, the murderers were radicalized by white supremacists who claim that immigrants are being brought here to dilute the whiteness of America.
Yeah.
Okay. So even though the attacks are specifically on synagogues and mosques, the undercurrent that they all have in common is a desperate hatred and loathing for non-white immigration. And I think that's important to bear in mind. It's a different kind of bigotry. This idea that, and I guess they hope to terrorize these various communities into not being welcoming to immigrants from other places. I mean, it's not like these people who are more indigenous than even Hispanic, who are coming up from places like Guatemala. It's not like they're going to just move right in and be celebrating Shabbat every Friday. No. And in point of fact, there's an important statistic out there, Scott. I don't know if you've seen this or not. But maggots were asked, do you believe immigration from south of the border has gotten out of hand? That's something like what the question was. And all the maggots polled said, well, hell yeah, how are we ever going to make America great again? All them people coming up here. Then they asked, has immigration from predominantly Christian countries gotten out of hand? And the maggots said, well, no. We need Christians. They're the same countries.
I sense a trick question on that second one.
Because they are predominantly Christian countries.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I know from my own experience as a human being, back in the early 70s, my own sitting down, you remember who George Lincoln Rockwell was, right? The guy who started the American Nazi Party. And they later renamed it National Socialist White People's Party, NSWPP, headquartered in Arlington, Virginia, just one town over from my hometown, Alexandria. And I used to engage the actual Nazis in conversations, sometimes on the phone, and it got to, because I wanted to get into their heads. Or you remember the story about wanting to bring a Nazi to sociology class my senior year in high school for show and tell? You remember that story?
Right.
Okay. Well, I wanted to get into these guys' heads because I couldn't figure out just what made them land on that particular space. And maybe it was morbid curiosity on my part. But anyway, at some point, this would be late at night, I would talk to the guy on the phone, and he would say, you know, he was catching some heat because he was tying up the phone. So I offered to drop by, and I said, you want me to bring you anything? And the guy said, well, you know, White Castle is a local D.C. chain, it may not be there anymore, of little hamburgers. And they're, if you're out on the town...
White Castle originated, I think, out in Indiana.
Not White Castle, Little Tavern. Little Tavern was like our local version of White Castle, but it was somewhat different because the hamburgers were not little that you could like cut so thin you could see through them. You could read newsprint through a White Castle patty. Not even hardly a patty. But anyway, that's not the story. So anyway, I picked up hamburgers for me and for him. I said, you want anything to drink? He said, well, yeah, Pepsi, if they've got it, because Coke is run by the Jews, which I never knew, but according to him it was. So anyway, I take the bag of burgers and the two root beers, since they had Coke and not Pepsi, and went over there and talked to them. Their line, according to George Lincoln Rockwell, was that one of the reasons that they didn't like Jews was they were Christ killers, so there's that. The other reason was all the Jews that have taken over, supposedly, this country and trying to take over the rest of the world were originally, a lot of them were from Russia or countries in Eastern Europe that later fell under communist influence. So they were all commies anyway. And in the 50s and into the 60s especially, the Jews linked up with the civil rights movement and underwrote it and supported it financially and, you know, with people showing up. So the Jews were trying to empower the Negroes, only he didn't say Negroes, okay? But this is their mindset.
So and so even that has some historical roots.
And this, these conversations go back to the like 74, 75, there in that space of time, to give you a time frame. And this was the official thinking, so-called, of the American Nazis. And you know it's only gotten more crazy in the intervening years.
Doubtless.
You know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, I mean...
And see, that's interesting, though, because, you know, the reason the Jewish community became such active allies in the civil rights struggle was because that faith system, and I'm skeptical of all religions. I mean, we already know that. But from an existential standpoint, that faith system is deeply concerned with what constitutes justice and how to administer it. And yeah. so too does Islam. And to a lesser extent, Christianity does as well. But Islam and Judaism are both deeply concerned with what constitutes justice. And those and in the ancient world, there was a lot of conversation about that. The same thing can be said for the ancient Greeks. You know, it's said that toward the end of his days, Socrates said, everybody says, Socrates, what is truth? Socrates, what is justice? Not one of you ever said, Socrates, hemlock's poison!
Put that down, Sock. Put it down.
But it makes sense that you would have a concern with what constitutes justice, because it's something that you can recognize justice from injustice, even if you are part of a Bronze Age culture that's still baffled by why it rains and looks at a wheelbarrow like a cow looking at a new gate.
Mm-hmm.
What? But that notion of how do we fairly treat each other becomes rather important, especially in sedentary societies that are moving away from hunting and gathering and toward an agricultural sedentary way of living. Because once you stay put, then you can't just go off and hunt or gather your way away from the assholes. That's okay. There's always going to be some more berries, roots and berries over the next ridge. Doesn't work that way. You're sedentary. You're there. And so you have to figure out how to live together. And so there's no surprise that those issues, you know, arise in that context. And if the neo-Nazis hated it in the 60s and 70s, well, their grandchildren and great-grandchildren hate it even more in the penultimate year of the second decade of the 21st century.
Yeah, because the rant on the part of people on the right, there was a time when it was somewhat veiled. They talked in code words, and they didn't come right out and say anything. I think we learned that from Lee Atwater, who was he? Reagan's man, George Bush's man.
Well, it was Pappy Bush's man, among others.
Yeah, but and I won't give the quote, but you can look it up. Just look up Lee Atwater and talking in code, and you'll get the quote. But over time, there has been a diminishment of restraint on the part of people who should really know better. I'm not talking about the Nazis and the skinheads and all. Maybe they, on some level, they should also know better. But when you've got sitting members in the Senate and the House and other people who would ordinarily be in positions of responsibility running interference for these asshats, these dangerous asshats, you know, and with the Jews will not replace us business, the people shouting that, who were they good folks from both sides or one of the two sides?
Well, if you ask one of the professional liars from the Trump regime, they'll say, Everybody knows that that's not what he said. He said the Nazis were bad, but he said there were some good people on both sides. No, he kind of didn't. So there's that. By the way, you've got a little tiny light pushback from a fellow San Diegan. This is Glenn, who says, pleased to remind Scott that San Diego is not necessarily the peaceful little burg he's depicting. Recall the Santana High School shooting in 2001, 2 dead, 13 wounded. We were also an early victim of the mass shooting dilemma, 1984, 21 dead, 19 wounded at McDonald's in the border town of San Ysidro, which is a community in the city of San Diego.
Yeah, Santana High was about a year after I got, less than a year after I landed out here, and I was still somewhere else, I guess back east or Midwest during the, God, that McDonald's massacre.
But, that, but like I said, meanwhile, the goddess of irony was really feeling kind of pissy this weekend because, you know, at the same time, they're having a palace coup in Taliban-dianapolis between Wayne the Peter and Ollie North.
Now, wasn't there some extortion? Not extortion, but...
Well, Wayne the Peter said that he was a victim of an attempt at extortion by Ollie. Ollie, meanwhile, was brought aboard with the promise that he would make scads of money through a PR advertising marketing firm that was attached, joined at the hip to the NRA.
Yeah, they do that. That's the company that they contract out to provide the programming for NRA TV,
right.
If I'm not mistaken.
Right. And so Ollie was paid a shit ton of money, and he's done exactly 4 TV shows for NRA TV. I think that was the number. But
the complaint officially reads, Ollie has done squat.
Yeah, and you know, for a figure that is in the tasty 6 digits.
There you go.
For 4 shows. So then he turns around and says, well, we've spent a whole lot of money on Wayne the Peter's suits. And a power struggle ensues. And then this one little mush-mouth goober, who's one of the first vice presidents or something, reads a letter from Ollie to the assembled faithful in which, because it was just delicious, in which he demoted Ollie. He referred to him not as Lieutenant Colonel North or Colonel North. He referred to him as Lieutenant North.
Oh.
Yeah, that had to go over well.
Now, wait a minute. I want to get our terminology correct. We've got MAGOTs. That's an acronym. Okay.
Right.
So we've also got now, this is the first time I've heard you say it, Mushmouth Goobers, MMG.
Well, that's a mushmouth gun goober, yes.
Well, ain't maggots must be goobers, then.
Well, no, your maggot can also be a goober. And a goob can also be a maggot. But gun goobs are that particular strain of maggot, and I understand it may be a distinction without a difference, but is particularly obsessed with firearms and engines of destruction.
Now, the fellow that whose name escapes me right now, the black fellow who's far right, who you play his video clips.
Oh, that would be Coleon Noir.
No.
No?
The other guy with the kind of speech impediment that, you know his name.
Jesse Lee.
Jesse Lee. Now, Jesse Lee, is he what you would call a mushmouth goober because of the speech hang-up?
No, I try not to pick on. No, it's not his speech impediment. It's the fact that he sounds like he's about a 1.75 liter bottle of Maker's Mark into it before the camera ever starts rolling.
Well, maybe that's it, and it sounds to my ear like, you know, a malformation of his speaking.
Do we still call them birth defects? Well, I think we do. Yeah. cleft palate or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and I don't mean to make fun of him because I've known people with that problem and it's not a fun
thing. But not every person who has dealt with a cleft palate sounds like they've been drinking since sunup. Jesse Lee does.
Well, there's that. And I've got a kind of an aside about the NRA. I heard on one of the news programs just in the last 24 hours that the the Secretary of State in New York State is thinking in terms of revoking their charter because, according to the report I heard, the NRA is chartered in New York. Won't that be fun?
Oh, joy.
Not revoking their charter, but taking away their tax-exempt status. They could still exist. They just couldn't write off their millions on their corporate tax return.
It's my understanding that that investigation is underway, and frankly, it would not be a bad thing if they lost their tax-exempt status because they don't exactly behave like one, seeing as how they endorse candidates.
Well, you think? I mean, come on.
But then again, the claim will be, no, we don't do that. We let our 501c4 organization do that because that's legal.
Jesus. It just doesn't seem to get any better. I mean, just when you think that we're making a little bit of progress and...
That's going to take a while.
Oh, I know. I know. Let me run this thing by you real quick. If it's all right, because I do want to clear up. I was talking to Chris the other day after the Friday on the Front Porch. For those who don't stick around for the after show proceedings, it can be fun. A group of us do hang on to the line afterwards and talk amongst ourselves, and it's highly entertaining and informative. But we were talking about, what the hell were we talking about? Something. And, God, I lost my thought, Bob. I know what it was. I was asking, do I call in too much on this show? And there was kind of not a consensus that I do, but I guess the idea was we'd like to hear from more people. So maybe I'll take a brief sabbatical. But let me leave you with this thing, because I've got to know. You were still in Alabama in like 77, mid to late 70s, right?
Yeah, I was in high school.
Were you anywhere near a place called Alexander City, Alabama?
No, that's rather a long way away from where I grew up.
Well, I saw the most unusual, interesting thing on CBS Sunday Morning yesterday, in addition to a piece about the movie Network, which I posted on your Facebook, the link to that. And I hope people do watch that link, because it was an interesting story about how Network, the 1976 movie, was prophetic. And we see in today's world the thing on steroids. But anyway, in a place called Lake Martin and the woods that surround Alexander City,
Alabama. Oh, there's some big bass in Lake Martin, Scott. I'm telling you, big bass.
But it ain't the bass they were talking about, Bob, on CBS Sunday Morning. Apparently, back then, there was a Reverend Willie Maxwell, an ordained Baptist minister, who also worked the local logging industry and could quote scripture and was overly polite. Well, one night in 1970, his first wife was found dead in her 68 Ford Fairlane.
Oh, I remember the story.
Okay, well, this is what I'm getting at. And then later on, he went on trial, and that worked out well for him because he was acquitted. He was suspected in her death, but was acquitted. And then he married a witness at that trial. But before long, she was dead. And it just goes on. Like this guy, some people thought he was into voodoo and all that. And apparently Harper Lee went to this place in Alabama for a couple of years doing research because she wanted to do a book on this case. And I have found precious little about it on the internet. Maybe I'm not searching using the correct search terms, but this would make a hell of a documentary. I'll send you the link and you can watch this little, it's only about a 4-minute piece or 5-minute piece on CBS Sunday Morning. It strange goings on.
Oh, but it, yeah.
But anyway,
whenever look, if you're in the South and a preacher's wife disappears, the first person you naturally look at is the preacher.
Well, the weird thing is, Bob, as these people were like getting all dead-like, okay, and he ended up the his stepdaughter was the actual daughter of one of these women that he married, and he was suspected in her death. And it turns out all these people that were dying, the good Reverend Willie Maxwell had insurance policies on them.
Well, so, praise Jesus for the foresight.
But wait, it gets better. At the service, Willie Maxwell, the good Reverend, gave the eulogy for his stepdaughter, who he killed, okay? And her brother or uncle or somebody, after the service, went up and shot old Willie Maxwell. I mean, you can't make this up. This is this is, who was it, Foster?
Right, and I'm sure, and I'm sure the defense later mounted was something that Harper Lee herself talks about in To Kill a Mockingbird, because she describes, Scout describes that Atticus had developed a considerable distaste for doing criminal law that stemmed all the way back to when he was defending a guy on a murder charge who insisted on mounting a "the bastard had it coming to him" defense.
Ah, okay.
And, but, you know, "the bastard had it coming to him" was probably the line of defense used after the Reverend Willie it got plugged.
But here's my question. Wasn't it Faulkner who said there's a good deal of madness in the South? Or am I thinking of another Southern writer?
Oh, hell, that could be Faulkner. That could be Eudora Welty. That could be, good man is hard, Flannery O'Connor. That could be Harper Lee.
Well, my,
because it's just the damn truth.
Well, that's what I mean. And you talk about madness in the South, Bob. That this has like MGM or Universal or Sony Pictures all over it, this story. And I thought I would be able on YouTube to
find
an old.
Yeah, but that's a pluribus unum. I can't come up with the particulars, but I can think of a couple of dead preacher's wife stories.
Well,
or the guy who flies away and they find the wreckage of his plane in the Gulf of Mexico, and then 20 years later, he's somewhere south of the border sipping margaritas. Or my particular favorite, and because it's an opposite take on the same thing. Patterson Hood of the Drive-By Truckers actually wrote a song about this particular incident. It takes place in Selmer, Tennessee, home of Buford Pusser, Walking Tall, all of that.
Yeah.
Rising star in the Church of Christ, and Church of Christ is big around there. And we're not talking about the United Churches of Christ, which is a fairly decent outfit, sort of liberal and forgiving. No, we're talking about a bunch of seriously holier than thous who won't even allow so much as a kazoo into the church because they found some psalm that says, "Sing and make melody in thy heart."
Yeah.
So they all just caterwaul with no accompaniment. Anyway, the song that Patterson Hood wrote, and I've played it on this program, is called "That wig he made her wear," or "those shoes he made her wear," something like that. Because and you cannot get any more Southern Gothic than this. She came home one night and got the family 12-gauge out, because down south there really is such a thing as the family 12-gauge.
Yeah. It hangs over the mantle.
And gave him a dose of double-aught buck right in the back at point-blank range. I mean, whoever came to clean up would have had to probably bring, you know, a colander and a rake. All right.
Well, you got me back for the olive loaf complexion.
I work at these things.
Yes, you do.
So she then took the kids and fled to the beach. No shit. She took the kids and went down to the Redneck Riviera for a while. Because, you know, after you've blown away your Church of Christ minister husband, you need a little beach time, you and the kids.
Yeah. You know, where are you going?
The pails, the buckets, the sandcastles, the, you know, fleeing from a scene of a murder. And when they got her and brought her back and they went to trial, they introduced as evidence in the trial the wig that she would have to put on in order for her good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical Church of Christ husband to be able to get it up and have sex with her.
This is ringing a bell, Bob.
And they brought in the hooker shoes, too.
Oh, Lord.
You know, the pole dancing shoes with the 4-inch platforms and the 7-inch heels.
I think the drag queens used to call those come fuck me heels.
No, these are different. These are pole dancer shoes. CFM pumps are something different. Those are the stilettos with the, you know, right. But
okay, well,
at least that's my understanding. Not that I have a deep understanding, but you understand.
Yeah, and I probably know more about it than I should.
Desperately trying to climb out of the hole I've dug for myself, yes. Wait a minute. Hold on. Did I hear Agnes laughing? Agnes is still laughing. We share a wall between the studio and the next room, you know.
Now wall's going to get higher if you keep talking, Bob.
It ain't the wall getting higher, it's the hole getting deeper.
Oh, yeah. There you go. The net effect, I'm telling you.
But, that's just any day that ends in Y in the South.
Or maybe it was Truman Capote who said there's a lot of madness in the South.
Well, he would know, having grown up and been a childhood pal of Harper Lee. Sure.
Yeah.
Remember, that's Dill Harris.
Yeah, of course.
As
yeah.
in, Dill Harris, do Jesus. That Dill Harris.
You know, I've never read the book.
Oh, it's ever so much better than the film. And the film film's lovely, but I hesitate.
Read in the link, Harper Lee, apparently her papers are sealed, but she sent what was probably the first chapter of a book to a publisher or somebody. And maybe she did write the book and just never got around to publishing it.
Could be.
I don't know.
Could be. Yeah, I'm looking at the link here. And I'll read it in greater depth when the program's over. I guess it's unfair to say that kind of lunacy doesn't take place in the rest of the country. It obviously does. It just seems that when those stories take place, there's something more about them when they take place, you know, in the confines of, you know, grits and biscuits and gravy with lots of biscuits with lots of lard in them.
The effect is heightened in the South because you've got the religious aspect to it.
Anytime a church splits up, and it happens, it's like some sort of mitosis. Anytime a church splits in the South, it's usually because somebody, the minister, the associate minister, the second vice associate minister, the minister of music, has been caught in flagrante delicto, which is Latin for bed, with some other member of the church hierarchy. So they go off and form their own church and it's kind of like when there are two queen bees in a hive, but one queen will fly away and take half the hive with her.
Yeah.
Well, that happens in Southern churches too, and it probably somewhere along the way it probably explains the truly craptastic politics of the South. But what I was going to say is I've become a little hesitant to talk too much about To Kill a Mockingbird because there's a whole lot of white saviorism in it that read with a more practiced eye, you notice and you kind of go, well, now, this is pretty gross.
Well, didn't that become apparent in her second book that came out a couple of years ago?
Yeah, Go Set a Watchman, in which Atticus has become a full-on racist.
Yeah.
And the thing is, she captured the tone of all that to perfection. Perhaps more so in that book than in the case of To Kill a Mockingbird. Because you can't not love Atticus Finch. And all the good characters. But if you delve into it, yeah, it gets kind of gross.
And I hear that Jeff Daniels has been, you can't even get a ticket on Broadway. They've taken To Kill a Mockingbird to Broadway. I saw a thing on.
Yeah,
on
with Aaron shows. With Aaron Sorkin doing the script rewrite. I got to admit, I'm a little skeptical.
Well, apparently it met with the approval of the Harper Lee estate. Not initially, they wanted. There was some, I forget what the particular was, but there was part of it that they wanted him to go back and do a rewrite. But they're using it. They're actually taking it to, like on the cast's day off, they're taking it to local, not colleges, I think auditoriums for middle school kids. And it's being used as a teaching tool, which is a pretty clever idea.
Interesting.
Because the movie, and it's been a few years since I've seen the movie, it was a, well, what year did that come out? 61, 2, somewhere
yeah,
in there?
Yeah, 62, I think.
You got to look back at the context of the times in this country. The that was a good message for America to see on the silver screen, and
no, in 1962 it was groundbreaking. It's just that while the Ewells and the Cunninghams are sort of the Ewells in particular are over the top evil, especially with the undertones of incest the real villain in the film is the entire white community and white power structure. You know, you got some decent people there like Sheriff Heck Tate and Atticus and Miss Maudie, but you know the Cunninghams. Mr. Cunningham, who brings the bag of hickory nuts for, in payment for Atticus, are working on his entailment. He's okay as far as it goes, but the minute the minute the issue of race comes up, you find out who Walter Cunningham's pappy really is.
Yeah,
and he's just a disgusting redneck racist, and there's no getting around it. And so it had its value on publication. It had its value as a movie. And you know, it was still being handed out to be read in ninth grade when I was a kid. And if you're not moved by it, there's something wrong with you. But if you do the detailed analysis of so-called white saviorism, there's a whole lot of assuaging of white guilt going on there. You know, when Jim and Scout and Dill are sitting up in the so-called Negro balcony of the courthouse, and the preacher, the African-American preacher, as Atticus is walking out, says, "Stand up, children. Your daddy's passing."
Yeah.
Oh, it'll give you chills.
Well, and I got...
But there's, you know, there's stuff about that that's just gross.
I don't believe that there's anything that we know about Harper Lee that would suggest that she held these attitudes. I think she was just giving a sense. Well, I mean, hell, that's where she grew up. You know?
Yeah, and see, Go Set a Watchman is actually what she was working on when she sent it to the publishers, and they wrote back and said, no, the part where you're writing from the little kid's point of view, give us more of that.
Yeah, I remember that.
Right. All right, well, let's roll out of here, and if somebody wants to jump in, they can, but otherwise, you know, we'll talk soon, okay?
All right, take care, Bob.
All right, be good, Scott. And okay, it sounds like Chirps is happier, so that's a good thing.
Well, she has eaten. She is now snoozing.
That's her job. We'll talk to you later, Scott.
To be a cat.
I know. Later. Bye. Our buddy Scott calling from San Diego. Catching up on the mailbag. No, Ron and Raleigh says, insane. If you think Jesse Lee is a loose cannon, have you caught T.J. Sotomayor? This guy's absolutely bug nuts and an anti-Semite. Oh, dear. I may have to check him out. That's almost... do I need more crazy in my life? don't get on the wrong side of the Viking warrior Pharaoh Princess Ali in New York. Subject line, shoes. Agnes is searching for your pole dancer shoes for after the show. I'm not sure whose pole dancer... What? It's so confusing. And Agnes is laughing again. Lee also notes, Ollie North is telling the public that he's leaving the NRA to spend more time selling snow tires in Central America. Jesus, yeah. And there's something in my ongoing... Wait, no, okay, this is too stupid not to feature it. It's more in Monday. Let's go to the White House, shall we? You may have noticed that the NCAA champion University of Virginia basketball team has elected not to go and visit with the venereal Vespasian. And of course, the head coach of the University of Virginia men's basketball team said, "This hadn't got anything to do with Trump. I mean, we got young men who are going into the NBA draft, young men who are going to." Look into other opportunities. They've left the team because apparently that's what you do when you play NCAA men's basketball. As soon as basketball season's over, you're gone. Fuck the grades. Take finals? Are you nuts? This is a business, not an education. But it'd just be too hard to get all the guys back together to bring them in and go to the White House. But on the other hand, the young women who played for the women's national championship Baylor team. Well, there's no way that Baylor University in Waco, Texas is going to, and remember, this is the same Baylor University who had Ken Starr for a president, who turned a blind eye to an almost epidemic, if it wasn't an actual epidemic, of campus rape, because Baptist. Well, there's no way that a Baptist university was not going to send its women's basketball team, national champions, to go and meet with Geezer Disgustus. So they did. Predictably, it didn't come off without a hitch.
First of all, thank you for inviting us. And we would like to present you with one of our jerseys.
Wow, I love that.
And it may not be the right size, but maybe Melania will wear it.
I'll give it to Melania.
Oh, yeah, it may not be the right size. No, they didn't. I don't think that, not in a 3XL. But maybe Melania will wear it, yes. Melania, who can't move a single muscle in her face.
Never mind, though. That's just, you know. Did you see Melania's birthday photo? That was just weird. But everything about her is like a real-world episode of the Mike Myers character Dieter's Sprockets. Now is the time on Sprockets when we dance. Leave my minky. Right, that. So the coach of the Baylor Bears women's basketball team notes that, no, the jersey may not fit, which was a cute little dig at the adipose Augustus's expense.
It may not be the right size, but maybe Melania will wear it.
I'll give it to Melania. You know, I love those short sleeves. Such beautiful arms. great definition.
Like I said, Melania may look better in it.
That's beautiful.
Chloe would like to.
That's beautiful. Let me get this one very importantly here.
Yeah, so he smiles for that. He shares the. Throw the front of the jersey. Later, however, Kalani Brown, one of the players, took note of the spread o hamburgers because they got the hamburger meal again. And this is what she posted.
Wow, like wow.
Like they was not lying. We ate all of barbecue sauce. Pizza, fries. Okay, Donnie. Cool.
Okay, Donnie. Cool. Oh God, wouldn't it be nice to have a not embarrassing president? Well, we've got our chance. It'll come our way in November of 2020. And before then, well, hopefully we can keep from tearing each other into tiny little bitty pieces so that we do have a chance in 2020. Great moments in job listings. This isn't. Apparently, in Virginia, there is a company called Cynet Systems, C-Y-N-E-T. One of their job postings on LinkedIn went viral. Job description, preferably Caucasian, who has good technical background, including knowledge of RPA, 8 to 10 years of experience, relationship individual who can get more opportunities and build the account. Mid-senior level, seniority level. Business development position, whatever that means. Cynet apparently enjoyed considerable popularity in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And nobody really knows the particulars of the ad, whether it was for them or for some client of theirs. But they went into damage control mode pretty quickly. Cynet apologizes for the anger and frustration caused by the offensive job post. You know, I think we can do without the judgment as to what people felt looking at that thing. How about Cynet apologizes for the offensive racist job post? Offensive? No. Racist, yes.
It does not reflect our core values of inclusivity and equality. The individuals involved have been terminated. We will take this as a learning experience and will continue to serve our diverse community.
Really? You're gonna take a job posting that said preferably Caucasian, wanted? Help wanted, preferably Caucasian? You're gonna take that as a learning experience? Really? Because you hadn't learned that was wrong in the first place? Learn from that now. Ah, lovely. Mm-hmm. Oh, and this.
Before we leave the... I mean, we're not leaving it, but... one other little detail about the synagogue shooting that I think bears mentioning. They're learning, these homicidal neo-Nazis and white supremacists, because they don't want to create too much trouble for their dear leader. So this guy expressly stated that he does not support Donald Trump because of Donald Trump's support for Israel. Interestingly, that's exactly what Louis Asparagus Gohmert was talking about. Some of his best son-in-laws are Jewish. Trump's. But the other thing is that he said, and this is far more chilling, is that conservatives aren't violent enough in advancing their politics. There is this guy, John Ernest, this murderous monster, was of the opinion that we don't have enough blood already flowing in this country, through this country, on this country, that there aren't enough dead. No surprise, I suppose, from a neo-Nazi, but regardless, that will be, I'm sure there's somebody out there that, I think he got a point. Now, from time to time, we've been talking about elements of impeachment. And I kind of went on a... I had one of those nagging little questions attack me over the weekend. Little things just buzz around your head and but you can never smack them and just completely wipe them out. Wait, what's that? Earther says, Baylor, but I just met her. Also, I ain't got no money. I'll be here all week. My car needs a motor, and I got two glass eyes. That was a very tepid cowbell for you there, Arthur. Well, thank you, Lee. I did choose my pronoun correctly, Lee says. Hope those shoes still fit, Bob. Not letting you out of your self-dug hole. No, of course not. Ah, business development, says Lee, means negotiating business with other companies. Still, preferably Caucasian. I spend some time thinking about what impeachment would look like, since there are a lot of us who would like to see it. Oh, now, wait a minute. Damn it, Kitty in Boston, that's just gross. But it's funny, too. With regard to the jersey, the basketball jersey, the Baylor basketball jersey, Kitty in Boston says, don't worry about the jersey not fitting. What he really wants is their underwear. Oh. Ew. So anyway, impeachment. there are two clauses in the Constitution that deal with it, the one that with the high crimes and misdemeanors, and the other one that explains that the Senate shall try the bill of impeachment and that a two-thirds majority is required to convict. So because I'm a curious soul, and because the question began to buzz around my head, this weekend I went and found the 1999 transcripts of the trial. Went on for a while, it did, and it was full of procedural wrangling. It, too, was a Republican Senate. Funny how Democratic Senates never get to try impeachments. Then again, there's a scenario out there whereby, I know, it's painful to even think about, he gets reelected, but we get a Republican House, or a Democrat House and a Democrat Senate. Might be different then. I prefer not to think about it. But I started thinking about what a potential Republican-run trial would look like under Mitch McConnell. And the first thing I got to thinking about was any trial procedure, one of the things you do is you swear in the jury. Now, in a courtroom proceeding, you have what's called voir dire, and you pick your jury. Each side has so many peremptory challenges they can issue where they can just knock people out for no reason or any reason. And then you go through and you query the jurors to make sure that you're going to theoretically get a fair panel. Well, it's not exactly like that when you try an impeachment in the Senate, because in that case, the Senate is the jury, all 100 members of the Senate, out of which you must have 67 votes yea in order to convict on a bill of impeachment. Well, after voir dire, when you've got your jury impaneled, you swear the jury in by oath or affirmation that they're not going to be that they'll judge the issue fairly, blah blah blah. So, like I said, I was curious to see what the oaths at the beginning of the Senate trial of the impeachment of Bill Clinton were. And, of course, the Constitution provides that in an impeachment trial of the president, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court serves as the presiding officer. And so it took some doing, but I found the transcripts. And here's the oath that was given to Chief Justice Rehnquist, who, by the way, if do you remember this? He wore a black robe with gold flashes on the sleeves because he got the idea from a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. No kidding. That's how much gravity the junkie William Rehnquist brought to the proceedings. He made it clear that it was a joke to him because he used an element from a comic opera. The president pro tempore of the Senate administered the oath. And the oath William Rehnquist swore was as follows. Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of William Jefferson Clinton, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws so help you God, at which point Chief Justice William Rehnquist, the junkie, he abused opioid medications before abusing opioids was even cool. I'm being sarcastic. Said, I do. But he was standing there in his comic opera robe, and so we knew pretty well where his head was. So once the Chief Justice gets sworn, he in turn swears in the Senate. After saying, I do, he turns around. He's now presiding over the proceedings. And he says, at this time, wearing my comic opera robe, will... No, he didn't say that part. At this time, I will administer the oath to all senators in the chamber in conformance with Article 1, Section 3, Clause 6 of the Constitution and the Senate's impeachment rules. It's that impeachment and the Senate's impeachment rules that played the largest part. Because if you go to Article 1, Section 3, Clause 6, what you find let me call it up here real quick. There we go. The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation. When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of 2/3 of the members present. Not a lot of detail in there. But it does say they shall be on oath or affirmation. It does not, however, say what that oath or affirmation is. That's where the part about according to the Constitution and laws and the Senate's impeachment rules. So having said that, he says, will all senators now stand and raise your right hand? Which they do. This is the moment in which he administers the oath to the entire body of the Senate who will serve as the jury in this trial. Only, if you're in the jury in a criminal trial, you don't get to stand up and declaim and make arguments. The jurors really seriously don't get to do that in either a criminal or a civil trial. The other thing you'd be surprised to find out is the amount of time that the Senate spent behind closed doors on this. So it was not fully an open trial available to every citizen of the United States and the world and the watching world. But there are pages after pages after pages of stentorian senators standing up and proclaiming and whatever. Juries don't usually get to do that. And wrangling over whether we will have people, whether we'll show video or whether we will actually call witnesses to the proceedings. And it all proceeds the way it does because of the nature of the oath. And that's my focus in all of this. I don't know if anybody in the multimillionaire for-profit media have gotten around to taking a look at the oath that is administered to a member of the United States Senate in a trial of impeachment, or at least the 1999 oath from the Clinton trial. But this is what the senators swore to. Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of William Jefferson Clinton, President of the United States, now pending, this is the important part, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, so help you God. Anybody see any problems with that? Because I see one that you could shove a mile-long railroad train through sideways. The phrase, do impartial justice, is modified by according to the Constitution and laws. The so help you God, you know, whatever. Do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws. Nothing in there about putting aside personal enmity, and certainly nothing in there forbidding them from acting according to the dictates of their political party. Because that's what they then did. They took their marching orders and behaved according to party. And frankly, you can say that about either side. But if we are going to talk about impeachment, then we'd better be talking about how senators behave in the trial. If they operate under that same oath, there's not even an argument to be made that the senators should put politics aside. That they should treat an obstruction of justice charge as impartially as a juror in a criminal case would. Because behaving according to your party is exactly what will happen. So you'll have 45 votes to convict and 55 votes to acquit. Fully 22 short of the 67 needed to convict on any count, whatever it may be. This is, of course, assuming that Mitch McConnell even allows it to go that far. He may just ask for a show of hands. You know, ask old John Roberts to come over, and maybe he can wear a clown suit instead of a robe with a back reference to Gilbert and Sullivan. He can just wear a clown suit and come over on a really big tricycle with, you know, horns and honking and big red nose and floppy shoes. And he can tell, and McConnell can say, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm going to swear you in. You swear? I swear. All right, everybody who's scared to death of Donald Trump and doesn't want to convict him, no matter what the charges were, no matter if there was video showing him doing everything he's charged with doing, so that there's no way you couldn't vote, so that there would be no way to acquit him. Everybody who just doesn't want to, say aye. Aye! Everybody know? No. Boom. He's acquitted. But in the event there's an actual something resembling a trial, there's how it happens that it won't be anything resembling based upon law or anything else. And impeachment is a political choice. It is a political act. It is a political question. But that oath allows the jurors to bring in whatever biases they wish, as long as the Constitution and laws aren't violated. It's a con. It's a con game. And anyone who thinks that chinless Mitch McConnell is going to do anything other than bow and scrape for Donald Trump really isn't paying attention. And if you're going to make the argument that the House has to do it, they have to do it, even though there's no have-tos in the Constitution, then you've got to understand that it is that the proceeding, while divided into two parts, is one cohesive whole, and the little scam that will be perpetrated in the Senate is as much a part of it as what the House does. And some people have said, well, then let the senators be on record for what they have done. They're happy to. The mortality of humankind is the only thing that's ever going to remove Mitch McConnell from his seat. When he gets so old that he shuffles off this mortal coil, Mitch McConnell will stop being a senator from Kentucky. Would that it were not true, but it is. And any of those mush-mouthed goobs from the Confederacy who would gladly toss Donald Trump's salad on any given day, they will not be punished. They will be rewarded for their behavior by the maggots back home. When you take a look at that oath and you combine it with the maggot base in places like the old Confederacy and other places where that sickness has spread, there's no way. There's not even a Powerball chance of a conviction. That's not to say the House can't or shouldn't, but I do think that we are well advised to acknowledge reality. Will there be a price to be paid? The Republicans didn't pay much of a price for what they did to Bill Clinton because, well, again, they were rewarded by their voters. That's what you get with a House divided against itself. So tell the world, you know, let us display to the world what his crimes are and have been. But let us not be so silly as to think that politics will not be the sole determining factor of any trial in the Senate. Okay? Because the very oath that the senators take does not compel them to leave their politics at the door. So there we go. Food for thought. Now we can wait 2 or 3 weeks until some member of the for-profit media decides to analyze that. Or maybe they won't bother doing that until and if a bill of impeachment is returned by the House. But as far as I can tell, we are way the hell out in front of the curve on most of the things touching the issue of impeachment and trial. Because that's why you tune in here, right? That and the food porn. So, that's it. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks for moderating the chat room this evening. Steve from Georgia Stan. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. 20 years leading the grassroots struggle for human rights and environmental justice in the Appalachian Sacrifice Zone. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.